Morning, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. The Baltimore Housing Authority is under fire for allegations that some tenants have been victims of sexual abuse by some maintenance workers. We'll visit the Gilmore Homes, the housing development where Freddie Gray was apprehended. We'll talk to a community organizer to get a closer look at what's going on and a scholar who studies urban housing. Then, with six key players entering free agency, the Orioles' future will be on the line this winter. Maryland Morning sports guru Mark Hyman joins me to talk about the O's and the status of the Ravens as they enter Week 5 with the game against the Cleveland Browns. Plus, the history of Guilford with the author of a new book about one of Baltimore's most affluent and storied areas. And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. That's all coming up right after the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Last spring, Freddie Gray was apprehended near the Gilmore Homes public housing project in Sandtown, Winchester, one of Baltimore's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. His death while in police custody focused a lot of attention on Sandtown and the many challenges that residents there face, including the conditions at the Gilmore Homes. Recently, several women who lived there said they were assaulted by maintenance workers who demanded sex in return for doing repairs in their apartments. Yesterday, producer Jonna McCone and I went to the Gilmore Homes, and we met Perry Hopkins. He's an organizer with Communities United, a group that advocates on behalf of the residents.
We're going to cut through. We're going to run past the rental office. You notice that you got a church. That corner building we looked at, right, was a like a senior center that really helps out veterans.
Gilmore Homes is in the heart of Sandtown. Public housing has been here since the 1940s. Gilmore seems a world away from the Nehemiah Project, the single-family dwellings that Enterprise Homes and Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development began building more than 20 years ago. But it's not. They're both part of the 72-square-block area that makes up Sandtown Winchester.
We're walking basically through the center of Gilmore Homes. Okay, we're on our way to a residence unit.
We walk to a two-story row house.
Hi.
Taisha Harrell is 31 years old. She lives in a three-bedroom unit with her five children, including seven-month-old twins and her sister. She's lived here for 4 years. She leads us into her tiny kitchen. There are holes in the walls where electrical outlets have been ripped out. Instead of a smoke detector, wires hang from the ceiling. Another part of the ceiling is falling in.
So you've had a problem with water damage in the ceiling.
And mice in the ceiling.
And mice.
Yeah, they eat through the ceiling.
Uh-huh. And then the electrical socket. What happened with that?
My daughter was standing here washing the dishes. Next thing, sparks, smoke, and popping noises just start coming out. And then I run in here. When she tell me, come in, you just see the smoke and stuff coming out the socket. My first reaction was to call the fire department. Mm-hmm. Fire department came. My power was off. They said the wiring is faulty.
I asked Taisha how she heats her home.
With my oven.
Your oven. Your oven is heating the whole apartment or just the kitchen? Or what's
just the downstairs. And if we have all the doors closed, it'll heat up the upstairs.
Are there radiators in the other rooms or electrical things for heat that are supposed to work that just don't? Or
yes.
And they just don't work?
They just don't work. Anytime we get, like last week when it was real cold, we had to open that oven because they still didn't turn our heat on.
And so you turn the gas oven on and you open the door, right? So that the heat comes out of the oven, and that's your only source of heat here in the kitchen and in the living room.
Yes, and blankets.
And the bedrooms, how do you heat those?
I leave my room door open and have the other doors crack so the heat could go upstairs.
The heat from the oven. Going up the stairs to the bedrooms up there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Taisha Harrell showed us around the rest of her home. We saw huge holes in the wall of one of the bedrooms caused, she said, by rodents. We saw tiles falling off the walls. We saw evidence of mold and roach infestation. The toilet leaks. In May, Peter Engel of the Baltimore Housing Authority told Jonna McCone that the city's public housing stock would cost more than $800 million to repair. More than $13 million was invested in the Gilmore homes in the early 1990s. We invited the director of the Housing Authority, Paul Graziano, to address the allegations against some of the maintenance staff. He declined, and his office issued a statement which said in part, quote, "The agency continues to actively conduct an internal investigation of the alleged sexual abuse. However, details of this pending personnel investigation cannot be disclosed." We've posted the full statement on our website. Joining me in the studio now is Perry Hopkins, who has been organizing in Sandtown for 6 months. Also with me is Eva Rosen. She's a postdoctoral fellow in the Johns Hopkins University Poverty and Inequality Research Lab. Welcome to you both. And Perry, thanks for taking us around yesterday. Let's start first with these allegations of sexual abuse. When you started working in Sandtown, this is one of the first things you heard about from residents.
Originally, I heard the maintenance man should just come to fix stuff and stop worrying about me. Okay, I began to hear it more and more, a little more graphically, a little more explicitly. It wasn't until we held our first community meeting, and honestly, the room was pretty much, we had mostly women. And when I asked for community problems, not individual problems, that we as a community and a group could solve, this took up more time and discussion than any other subject.
So it sounds like this has been going on for a while. This is not a new problem.
Yeah, and what I used as a basis in verification of that was a lot of the residents that were speaking had been there for many, many years. There was also a cry that it's always been that way. Girl, you know, that's been going on for years. It was that type of, they had an acceptance almost.
We should make note that Taisha Harrell, whom we spoke with yesterday, is not part of this lawsuit. She's not one of the people making this
Very, very fortunately, she is not.
Yeah. Eva Rosen, how did public housing in this city and cities around the country get to be in such deplorable shape?
So in the 1990s, Congress created the National Commission on Severely Distressed Public Housing to actually investigate the state of public housing across the country. And what they found was that there were a significant number of units that really were what they called severely distressed. So what that meant was two things. It meant that families were living in extreme poverty in many cases, living in neighborhoods that were very poor with few jobs and high crime very often. And secondly, it meant that the actual physical state of the buildings was just in a really deteriorated condition. And so as a result of this, we saw a lot of high-rise public housing torn down all over the country, especially in Baltimore. But we still have places like the Gilmore Homes and various low-rises and some high-rises that still exist that house some of the city's poorest residents. But what we see is that these buildings are still, despite the money, some of the money that we've put into them, often in really poor condition. I've seen all of the conditions that we just heard about. I've seen residents who not only who had bed bug infestations, but elderly and disabled residents who have to wait 20 minutes at a time just to get in the elevator to go downstairs and go grocery shopping or see the doctor.
There are over, I'm going to say approximately, 1,500 unanswered work orders.
In Gilmore Homes alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, lately, since Communities United has been working in the neighborhood and we have brought light to the living conditions, we have challenged a lot of their processes on regard of the resident, using the residents to step forward. It's a lot of quick fixing going on.
Eva Rosen, not all residents who are living in subsidized housing in Baltimore are living in public housing units. There's, of course, the Section 8 program that has private landlords providing housing. What's your research on the private landlords in Section 8 and how successful that is?
When it comes to the question of providing safe, affordable housing, we worry about public housing residents, but we also worry about other subsidized renters, like those who receive vouchers, and especially about also folks who don't receive any assistance. Only a quarter of families who qualify actually receive assistance. So I've studied low-income residents and landlords in Baltimore in particular. To try to think about this transition that we've seen in the past 20 years to some degree away from public housing towards using vouchers to allow families, in theory, to choose a home in the private market that's affordable and that works for them. And Some policymakers hoped that they would get to neighborhoods that were maybe better neighborhoods than public housing has historically been located in, neighborhoods and units that were perhaps in better condition than public housing was and is. What this means is that we see this sort of whole new actor who's introduced into the scene, right? So the private landlord is a whole new person with his or her own needs and desires and motivations, and so we might worry about what kinds of regulations there are or aren't in that setting that's a bit more in the private market. So in some ways, we might worry that this could happen even more in a setting like that.
So Perry, you've been organizing in Sandtown for about 6 months now.
Yeah.
Obviously, these allegations of sexual abuse are terribly serious and will be litigated because now a lawsuit has been, begun. What are the other priorities for the residents there in the short term and then looking a little further out?
Well, currently, along with the input of the residents, Community United has been circulating a petition for some immediate need fixes. We've asked that all of the security lighting on the outside, exterior lighting, be made operable. Because when the sun goes down, if you were to walk down that sidewalk in 15 seconds, if I walk behind you, you'd be invisible. We've also had a break-in that was under camera, and I have a Baltimore City police officer on tape stating if the lights outside were on, they would have been able to clearly identify the subject, but only had shadows. Second, we're asking that all of the electrical sockets in those units be equipped with a circuit breaker or GFI because the wiring is so old.
So they have fuse boxes in many of these apartments.
They have fuse boxes in almost every one of them. And thirdly, in light of the winter coming in, the number of children and families currently inhabiting that complex, do you know that over 3/4 of those units are single-paned windows? There's one tiny piece of glass between the elements and a family with, as we've heard, unworking heat. So we've asked that those three things be addressed immediately. So far, we've got no response.
Is this a matter, Eva Rosen, simply of, money being available? Or do you suspect that this has something to do with political will as well?
I think that money is a big part of it. I think that since public housing was created in the 50s and 60s, we have not seen the federal government willing or able, that's a whole other story, but we have not seen enough money invested to maintain the housing infrastructure that we have. And these problems have come and gone throughout the history of public housing. When we put families in situations, particularly in poor housing conditions, is it puts them in a really systematically vulnerable position where this kind of exploitation can flourish. And if we want to change that, we need more oversight, and we need to change some of these on the ground, daily operations of the way these housing projects are managed. But we also need to consider whether or not we're willing to actually invest in maintaining these buildings.
Well, I appreciate both of your coming in and helping us shed some light on this. This is something we will continue to take a look at. So we will be in touch with both of you in the future. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Perry Hopkins works in Sandtown, Winchester with Communities United. Eva Rosen is a postdoctoral fellow in Johns Hopkins University's Poverty and Inequality Research Lab. One more thing about the public housing segment we did to open the show today. Paul Graziano, the director of Baltimore Housing, sent a letter to residents of all the public housing units in Baltimore, which is quoted in today's Baltimore Sun in a story by Luke Broadwater. He says, quote, "I'm writing to let you know personally that the Housing Authority of Baltimore City prohibits its employees, contractors, and vendors from engaging in vulgar, unprofessional, or inappropriate conversations and conduct, including sexual harassment." So he's encouraging people to step forward if they have had that experience. It's Maryland Morning. Lots more coming up after the news. First, here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Thanks, Nathan. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to turn now to our good friend Mark Hyman, On Sunday afternoon, the Orioles wrapped up their 2015 season with one last winning streak, but even after sweeping the Yankees, and let's face it, that was pretty sweet, the Birds finished the season in baseball purgatory at exactly 500. They won 81, and they lost 81 games. While we did technically avoid a losing season, O's fans view this past year as a disappointment after getting to the American League Championship Series just the year before. What's more is that six big contributors to the Orioles' success, including the reigning home run champion Chris Davis, are entering into free agency. So players, analysts, and fans alike agree that this offseason could be make or break for the Orioles. And just down the road on Russell Street, the Ravens are in unfamiliar territory. They're tied with the Cleveland Browns for last place, with the likes of Terrell Suggs, Marshall Yanda, Dennis Pitta, and Steve Smith Sr. on the DL. The Ravens have a 1-3 record that marks their worst season start since 2005. So we are joined by Maryland Morning sports guru Mark Hyman. He's a professor at George Washington University, where he teaches courses in sports management, and his most recent book is called Concussions and Our Kids. Good morning, sir. Good to see you.
Hi, Tom. Good to be in Baltimore.
Yes, indeed. The Orioles offseason, what's their charge? What do we need to do to turn things around?
Well, I think that there are certain key pieces that they may lose because, you know, six important parts of the team, free agent players, all of whom could walk, and I think it's going to be they're going to have to make some strategic decisions about which pieces are most important. And if they lose players like Chris Davis and Matt Wieters and Darren O'Day, can they bring in other pieces that are going to compensate for that loss?
You know, it's tough. Like at the end of last season, all of a sudden Nick Markakis goes to Atlanta. Nelson Cruz, who had been so productive at the plate for the Orioles in their run to the ALCS, was traded. On the other hand, you know, you take a look at a guy like Markakis, you pointed out to us earlier this summer, his first home run for Atlanta wasn't until July. By the end of the season, Nick Markakis had only hit three home runs for Atlanta. That's actually three more than you and I hit this year. it's tough to know sometimes how trades are going to affect people. Is it a matter of, you know, with people like Matt Wieters and Chris Davis, who is the home run champion, is it a matter of Mr. Angelos's reluctance to spend money? What is it? Is it simply that, or is it anything more than that?
Well, let's take a step back. Why do we talk about payrolls in baseball? And we seldom talk about them in football. I think it would be helpful to talk about that. The National Football League has a salary cap, what is referred to as a hard cap. So each team is limited to pretty much the same salary obligations. Every team the same. This year it's $143 million. So the Ravens can't exceed that number, nor can the New York Giants or the San Francisco 49ers. Baseball is very different in this respect. The Los Angeles Dodgers this year had the largest payroll in baseball, and it was three times the payroll of the Miami Marlins, which had the lowest payroll. So there's a lot of speculation and really not that much knowledge about what goes into the logic of what a team wants to spend on talent. We don't really know what the Orioles' profits are or their revenues are. We don't know that.
It's not like it's a publicly traded company and we get that information on a quarterly basis. Yeah.
No, it's a privately held company. So, you know, the Orioles are making decisions on, with information that we don't have access to.
And it's weird. It's kind of like, it reminds me of valuation in the art market. You know, why does one painting, you know, cost more than the GDP of several Caribbean countries? You know, who decides? You know, it's the market. So, you know, what does it mean to overpay or underpay a player in Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I mean, the salaries of Major League Baseball players rise significantly every year. And people focus on that and wonder, you know, why should Chris Davis may make $30 million next year. That's a possibility. This year he made $12 million. Now, it's true that next year, you know, he's entering his eligibility for free agency, so his status is changing. But, you know, people look at that and they wonder, how could a player who was worth 12 last year be worth 30? You know, one thing I'd like to point out is think about the valuation of professional sports franchises. Peter Angelos bought the Orioles in 1993 for $173 million. At the time, that was the highest price ever paid for a professional sports franchise. Bloomberg Sports recently valued the Orioles at $1.1 billion. So everything having to do with sports is escalating in value, both player salaries and, of course, the value of franchises themselves.
Yeah, Carl Sagan, that's billion with a B. I mean, that's a lot of money for a franchise. But, you know, for example, Adam Jones made news a few days ago by saying that this summer or this winter he's going to meet with Mr. Angelos to appeal to him to make a bigger investment in the team. You know, what do you think that what are the metrics that a guy like Mr. Angelos is making? Because there are other metrics, sort of famous metrics. You know, you've got the sort of money ball approach to baseball, saying you don't need big stars, you need people who do little things well. Yeah. Do you think Angelos is adapting that strategy, or a sort of an amalgam of stars and money ball players?
I'm sure he wants a competitive team on the field because it's in his financial interest to do that. You know, it's important that people feel that the team beginning the season has a chance to be competitive and advance to the postseason. I think it's going to be very interesting. I think last offseason is going to be instructive and may inform what the Orioles do. The Orioles allowed two pretty significant players to leave via free agency last year, Nelson Cruz and Nick Markakis, the player that you mentioned. Nelson Cruz hit over 40 home runs this year. He would have been a very important piece. The Orioles season may have ended very differently if Nelson Cruz had been signed to a contract. Nick Markakis only hit 3 home runs for the Atlanta Braves, and that's not very many for a corner outfielder. Yet he hit .295, and he would have been an upgrade over what the Orioles had in right field this year. And in fact, you know, I think it's important to point out the Orioles replaced Nick Markakis with players who did not measure up in any way. The Orioles had 5 outfielders on their roster during the season that they released during the season. So, you know, Dan Duquette, who is the essentially the general manager of the team, he made some personnel decisions that certainly could be second-guessed this year.
Speaking of personnel decisions, let me try this scenario on for size with you. Dan Duquette, who voiced some interest in leaving the Orioles and going to work for Toronto, I guess, leaves. Buck Showalter is replaced as a manager. He becomes the general manager of the team, and Cal Ripken becomes the manager of the Orioles. Is this crazy talk?
This sounds either like a dream or a report that I read in the New York Post recently. Yeah, Joel Sherman.
So difficult to discern between those two things, at least in my life. I know what you mean.
Joel Sherman of the New York Post reported last week that and this has been reported elsewhere, that during the season there was friction between Dan Duquette and Buck Showalter, which would not be surprising given the kind of season the Orioles had. And that one scenario that had been discussed was for Buck to move upstairs and to the front office and for Cal to be the manager. And all sides have denied this. The Orioles have, and Cal's people have indicated that this is not something that has been discussed. And even last week, Buck and Dan Duquette indicated that they would be back next year in their same job. So I think we have to take them at their word.
Cal Ripken, it seems, aspires to be a major league manager. He's certainly a legendary Hall of Fame player. What's your take about his temperament, his experience, his proclivity for being successful? The Nationals fired their manager, Mr. Williams, and there was some speculation in Washington that Cal Ripken perhaps would be a candidate for that job. That seems to have been tamped down by the management of the Nationals. In general, whether he's managing here or someplace else, would Cal Ripken be a good major league manager?
You know, the only thing that Cal hasn't really done in his career in baseball is manage. He's done virtually everything else. And I think he would be a good manager. And I think, although he hasn't explicitly said so, I think he really very much would like to manage in the big leagues. I think that's the one part of his resume that is kind of missing and that he would enjoy doing. He's in a difficult spot because the job I think that he most wants is the Orioles job. And unless Buck elects to move to the front office or do something else with his life. I don't see an opportunity for him right now.
Can a player as good as Cal Ripken, a player as, you know, dominant when he was playing, can he relate to the younger players, to rookies, to kids, or to people, even veterans, who just don't have that kind of basic gift that he had?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are two managers who began the season this year who are Hall of Famers, Ryan Sandberg and Paul Molitor. And Ryan Sandberg was manager of the Phillies. And, you know, of course, their teams were very different. Ryan Sandberg's team, the Phillies, were not a good team. And Sandberg resigned in the middle of the season, had a miserable season. And I think you'd have to say was a failure as manager of the Phillies. Paul Molitor, on the other hand, had never managed before. And he took over the Twins, and they had a very good season and were in the wild card hunt until the last day of the season. So I don't think one's status as a Hall of Famer is disqualifying or elevates somebody as a potential manager. I think the challenge for Cal would be, the primary challenge is that he's never managed at any level and in fact, has never been a major league coach. And that's a hole in his resume that I think gives pause to some clubs.
On 88.1, Mark Hyman joining me here in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. We're talking sports. Let's talk a little bit more about baseball. Rob Manfred, the current commissioner of Major League Baseball, spoke at the National Press Club a while back and said, raised the specter that there might be a Major League franchise in Mexico. What do you know about that?
Yeah, I attended this event. It was very interesting. And Rob was asked about expansion, Major League expansion, and he indicated that the next Major League franchises likely would be located in Canada or Mexico, not in the U.S. And, of course, Montreal is a site in Canada that is likely because there's been Major League Baseball in Montreal. But he actually made a visit this week to Mexico and seems to be very enthusiastic about the possibility of Major League Baseball in Mexico. And the Mexican government or business interests there, they're interested too, because when Manfred arrived at a new stadium that had been built, there was a plaque, a Rob Manfred plaque that had been erected at the stadium. So they're clearly lobbying Rob Manfred.
The froggy comes a-courting there, huh?
So, yeah, it seems that Mexico is a potential expansion site.
Bud Selig, the former commissioner, gave an address at the Smithsonian around the same time Mr. Manfred was speaking at the National Press Club, and he had a somewhat iconoclastic suggestion for Major League Baseball, and that is that Marvin Miller, who headed the Players Union, should be in the Hall of Fame. This is Mr. Miller, known for many years among Major League management as Darth Vader. What are the chances of that happening?
Well, it was interesting. I'd never heard Bud Selig say anything kind about Marvin Miller, or any owner say anything kind about Marvin Miller, because he really changed the game in a fundamental way. When Marvin Miller became executive director of the Major League Players Association, that was in 1966. The average player salary was $17,000. This year it was $4.25 million. So you have to say that he was, you know, a transformational
figure. Pretty effective guy. Yeah.
He was. He died in 2012 in his 90s and was not in the Hall of Fame, and it was kind of a disappointment to a lot of people, including Marvin Miller. So I was very pleased to hear Bud Selig say that.
Just got a little bit of time left. Let's talk about the Ravens. There are a whole lot of folks that are banged up and hurt on the Ravens. Do we have anybody at the moment who is skilled at catching passes who isn't on the injured list?
Well, it's a problem because, you know, Joe Flacco has a great arm and likes to throw the ball downfield, and the Ravens, really, their deep threats are on the bench right now. It'll be interesting to see if Steve Smith Sr. plays. He was after the Bengals game, he was diagnosed with multiple micro fractures in his back, which would put me out for about 10 years. But they're talking about the possibility that he might play on Sunday. And the Ravens have had other injuries. Breshad Perriman, their number one draft pick, was injured in practice on July 30. He has not he's not played.
And Coach Harbaugh seems to be a little miffed at that. He's wondering why it's taken Mr. Perryman so long to come back.
Yeah, he referred to the injury as one of the all-time slowest to heal this week, which is not what you want to hear from your boss.
Well, they do have a schedule that gets a little easier for the next few weeks. They had a bad start, certainly, with losing the first three games. But, you know, let's see what happens with them. I want to talk very briefly about Randy Edsall. It appears he's on the ropes at the University of Maryland as the football coach.
Yeah, Maryland is having a dismal year. They lost to Bowling Green. If you're a Big Ten team, you don't lose to Bowling Green.
Yeah.
But it remains to be seen whether he will survive after this weekend as coach.
Of course, if they decide to terminate his contract, it's going to cost the University of Maryland, ergo the taxpayers of the state of Maryland, a whole lot of money to release him.
So it'll be expensive.
It's a complicated decision. All right. Well, Mark, always good to see you. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Mark Hyman is a professor at George Washington University, where he teaches courses in sports management. He's the author of three books. The most recent is Concussions and Our Kids. Stay with us. Still ahead on Maryland Morning, a history of Baltimore's Guilford neighborhood.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning again on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We turn now to a local historian who has written a book about the neighborhood of Guilford in North Baltimore, originally the country estate of the founder of the Baltimore Sun, A.S. Abel. Since 1913, it has been one of Baltimore's most beautiful and affluent neighborhoods. Anne Giroux lives in Guilford. Her book is part of the Images of America series, which includes books on many other neighborhoods and institutions in Baltimore and beyond. Anne, it's nice to meet you.
It's great to be here.
So what makes Guilford historically important?
So Guilford is part of the larger Roland Park Company District. Actually, the entire district here in Baltimore City is very important. Wasn't the first, but was highly influential. In other words, they were really, they started in 1891, but after about a decade, Edward Boughton, who was in charge of the Roland Park Company, really had his fingers on the pulse of national trends, international trends. So what he was really the master of was taking the best of those trends and doing them here in the Roland Park Company District and then retransmitting those to other developments across the nation.
So the Roland Park Company teamed up with the Olmsted brothers, Frederick Law Olmsted and John Charles Olmsted, to design Guilford. They also, of course, designed Roland Park. What was the Roland Park Company? Was this a private thing that was working on behalf of the city jurisdiction? How did
out of towners. They were out of towners. So it was interesting. One of their challenges is a consortium. And the consortium changed over time. There had been a syndicate that came in and had international funding that ended up pulling their money out. So a lot of these people were Kansas people who were coming in. They weren't even from the area, who were basically experiencing a challenge of trying to tell Baltimore how they should live. In other words, move to the suburbs, but they had to tread carefully.
Yeah, because, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
And Guilford and Roland Park in those days are huge suburbs. I mean, this
exactly.
is just way out in the middle of nowhere. The estate of Mr. Abel was sold for $1 million in 1907. That seems like a lot of money now, and it was certainly a lot of money.
So
these folks were taking a pretty substantial financial risk.
Yes and no. One of the things about Roland Park, which was not the case for Guilford, is that very first plat was really out there. It seemed and felt remote because it really was. It was all about getting there. It was all about, okay, how are we going to get people to understand? How are we going to get rail laid? But Guilford was not. Guilford, by 1913, when Guilford was developed, Guilford was in the thick of things. It was hundreds of undeveloped acres, but surrounded on one side by Waverly, which was already a bustling community. And St. Paul Street had been developed all the way up to the base of Guilford.
So getting there and getting out of there was not
a problem.
Nearly as complicated. Yeah. You write that they had three goals when they designed Guilford. Number one, they wanted consistent and harmonious development. So they were going to sort of control what the houses and the buildings look like. Two, they wanted luxury and affordable homes. They didn't want them all to be sort of high-end places. And they wanted it to be integrated with the development next door. And by the development next door, what do they mean there?
So Guilford, another distinction here with Guilford is that Guilford was really one part of a multi-pronged redevelopment or reimagining of that entire portion of what was Baltimore City and at the time the lower part of Baltimore County. It was a seismic move from the city core, not only of top-tier residences, but also of ecclesiastical buildings, academic campus of Johns Hopkins, we now call the Homewood Campus, eventually the Baltimore Art Museum. So it was really a seismic shift of organizations that all sort of began to be constructed around the perimeter of Guilford.
And was it pretty coordinated? I mean,
yes, highly, tightly coordinated.
So the BMA and the Episcopal Cathedral and Guilford as a neighborhood, they were all being designed together and
it was all tightly coordinated. The BMA, of course, came a little bit later. It was one of the later things to go in, but
Guilford certainly did not pioneer, and you write about this, they did not pioneer discriminatory housing practices. For example, Jews, African Americans, and in one document you quote, they were looking to exclude foreigners with, quote, impossible names.
Right.
They didn't want them living in Guilford. But you say that it helped proliferate these practices elsewhere.
So I referenced that earlier when I was talking about the Roland Park Company District here in Baltimore being an important node of transmission. One of the things they transmitted fairly aggressively and actively were exclusionary housing practices. I actually had a lot of material that I could not include in this book. I tracked down a lot of people whose relatives had been excluded based on their professions or their religion or ethnic background from the district and got their stories. So it was interesting.
What kind of professions were they dead set against?
Undertakers were particularly discriminated against initially. Major undertakers had in the past, in the city core, had their homes and their businesses often either side by side or in one building. And that was something the Roland Park Company did not want to see.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take for African Americans, Jews, and others to be able to integrate and be able to buy and live in Guilford?
It took longer for African Americans. Actually, it took that was the longest that it took. And the Depression actually broke down the other discriminatory practices, the so-called gentlemen's agreements, fairly soon. The company lost control over who was selling to whom. For financial reasons, people were selling to anybody who had the money to pay for those homes.
Mm-hmm. The designers wanted to have places, what they called places, as well as gardens. There's a bunch of beautiful gardens in Guilford. Sherwood Gardens is one that a lot of people know. What did they mean by places?
So places was actually a term the Olmsteds themselves came up with. They use it in quotation marks themselves, and I've continued that. That means cul-de-sacs. That means nooks and crannies that they're putting in to create calmer areas. The roadways, in other words, tend to get smaller. So you might have these little places radiating off of the community in various places. We have them in Guilford, north, south, to the east, all over. Roland Park has them as well, and as does Homeland.
So these three goals that they had, the consistent development, the luxury and affordable homes, the integration with the development next door, that's what they were trying to do. So as we sit here in 2015, you live there. Did they succeed?
Yes, they did. They absolutely succeeded. It's one of the best preserved developments of this period in the nation.
Well, I appreciate your coming by. It's fun to read the book and to see some pictures of some houses that are still there.
They're all still there.
They're all still there. And, it's amazing to think that this was all sort of dreamed up by a bunch of guys from Kansas City.
Absolutely.
All right, Angie Ruth, thanks so much. Appreciate your coming by. Her new book is called Guilford. It's part of the Arcadia Publishing Images of America series. Angie Ruth will be leading a walking tour of Guilford with an architect, David Gleason, on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. She'll also talk about the book at the Roland Park branch of the Enoch Pratt Library on October 28th. We've got links to all the details on our website. Come on over to wipr.org/Marilyn Morning.
Coming up Monday, we'll check in with Kenneth Burns and Fraser Smith from the WYPR News Department for a roundup of local news and a look ahead to the Democratic primary debate. That's happening on Tuesday night. Marvin Pinkert will also be here. He's going to talk about a terrific new exhibition at the Jewish Museum of Baltimore on the iconic singer-songwriter Paul Simon. And we'll have a conversation with Ann Tyler about her latest novel, which has been nominated for a Man Booker Prize. That takes place in Roland Park, as a matter of fact. That's all happening Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Nathan Sterner is my co-pilot, and our director and engineer, Jonna McCone, and Connor Graham produced the program with production assistance from Scott Seiss. Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville gives us our Java fix every morning. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. Thanks to Chris Kennedy and Clean Cuts Music for our theme song, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Tom Hall. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.